Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. L. Frank Baum found his calling as the author of The Wizard of Oz at the end of a long string of failed careers. He bred fancy chickens, wrote plays, ran a newspaper into the ground. But in 1900, at age 44, he pulled from his failed professions and spiritual search a world of flying monkeys and magic slippers of tiny munchkin people and narcoleptic poppy fields. It's been called America's first native fairy tale. Every child knows its power. This hour on Point, how L. Frank Baum was inspired to write The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. You can join the conversation. What is it about this story, the book, the movie, Dorothy, Toto, There's No Place Like Home, that gets us going? Can you feel the currents that must have inspired L. Frank Baum? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Evan Schwartz. He's a former editor at Businessweek magazine. His fascinating, provocative new book is Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. Evan Schwartz, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
You want to hear it? Right away. Here it is. Let's get right into it. 1939, Victor Fleming film. The Good Witch Glinda tells Dorothy the Wizard of Oz will help her get home to Kansas. And there's only one path to the wizard. Here's Dorothy, played by Judy Garland with the Munchkins.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road.
Okay, there it is. I'm 7 years old again, and I'm in the trance. I'm ready to hide behind the couch when the Wicked Witch of the West comes on. Every American is gripped by this, and not only Americans. The book was huge. She was the J.K. Rowling of her time. You say the movie was huger, to be ungrammatical. I mean, just enormous, and continues to be. Get us started here. Yellow Brick Road. What? Flying monkeys? Munchkins? I mean, it's preposterous, and yet it's utterly gripping. Why?
Well, yeah, there's this endless fascination with The Wizard of Oz, and when you watch the movie, it's not hard to see why. It's endured for 70 years, and it's cut like a modern film. But
that's just filmmaking. This thing is somehow getting its fingers
exactly
around our American soul or something. What's going on?
It's not just a piece of entertainment. You know, underneath it is this very powerful story. And where does the story come from? L. Frank Baum was the person who invented all these icons. And my quest was to figure out where it all came from. How did this one man who failed at a series of careers come up with this iconic story?
You open the book describing him, 1898, and he's in his 40s already, and it's been a pretty miserable life so far. He began life in Syracuse, New York. Father was a cooper, a barrel maker, did pretty well. They lived on a wonderful estate there, kind of paradise. I mean, you start giving us the little echoes of what's to come here. There was a plank road alongside the farm, you know, rare in those days. But Syracuse, the beginning of the Erie Canal. So
that's
people
right.
had to get the produce in there. But here he is after a whole lot of careers all over the country and in the West, out in that blank prairie land. And he sits down and suddenly all these images comes to him and he starts to write with his favorite pencil. By the fall of 1899, you tell us, that pencil was just a stub and he fastened it into a frame, surrounded it with a caption. With this pencil, I wrote the manuscript of what he then called the Emerald City, sealed the frame, hung it on the wall in the den of his Chicago home, and the rest is history. But tell us about, what do we need to know about his life to begin with? And then we'll get to the spiritual search, which is interesting.
Yeah, I was inspired to write this book when I was rereading Baum's novel out loud to my daughter at bedtime. And we came to this perplexing bio at the end. You know, he failed at this series of careers. And then at age 42, he comes up with this fantastical story. And he was not an author for most of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And
chicken farmer, actor,
yeah.
oil merchant, newspaper publisher.
And he had a dream when he was a kid to become a great author, but life got in the way. He met this beautiful girl and got married. And
she was at Cornell. He was in upstate New York. Maud, his wife.
Yes. And she had this mother who, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, was the leading radical for the women's movement and was against the marriage. So life got in the way.
And we're not talking about just some minor league women's movement person. She's right up there with Susan B. Anthony. And I mean, there's photographs in the book of her sitting with them. This was a big-time women's rights advocate and a tough one who made his life miserable sometimes.
Yes, and the inspiration for The Witches, which we'll get to later. Mm. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the Yellow Brick Road because this is where the magic of Oz comes from. Frank Baum saw a Yellow Brick Road. In fact, it's still around, this piece of Yellow Brick Road in Peekskill, New York, that's where he was sent away when he was a teenager to go to military school.
Yeah.
And it was a very dark and difficult time for him, but he saw this Yellow Brick Road.
Literally,
and
made by the Dutch, the kind of Dutch-style kiln-fired, ceramic road?
Yes, and it wasn't that uncommon to see a Yellow Brick Road back then, but that's the genius of his story. He took these common sights and he combined it with spiritual meaning. You know, we hear that first phrase that you just played, follow the Yellow Brick Road, and it sounds like a spiritual quest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Glinda is saying the way you will find your way back home is to go see this wizard, someone who no one has ever seen, yet he's mysterious and powerful. And who does that sound like? Well, it sounds like God, and you're going to seek the wizard and follow this Yellow Brick Road. Well, it turns out Frank Baum later in life embraced this New Age faith called theosophy. His mother-in-law first embraced it, but Frank Baum was a spiritual seeker, and he was trying to find meaning in life, and he was trying to find his path back to who he really was.
The true self, capital T, capital S.
Yes, that was a big thing back then.
In the late
19th century, for speakers of spirituality. For Frank Baum, it was very practical. He wanted to find out what he was cut out to do. He failed at everything he did, and he knew he had a special talent, yet he didn't know he would be a children's author.
Give us a sense of this time. Dorothy's little house in Kansas is famously blown away in the cyclone and the tornado. But you remind us that these were and had been kind of cyclonic times for all of America.
Yeah, it's another way that he combined a common sight, a tornado. He lived in South Dakota for a while, where these tornadoes came ripping through the landscape every spring.
And that was an environment, you remind us, that to Eastern Americans was absolutely overwhelming. These huge treeless plains, tornadoes themselves seen much more commonly there. A tornado, as I think I recall reading, photographed for the first time ever, a black and white photograph of a tornado make it into popular circulation. That itself was kind of a big deal, that you could see it and stare at it, that funnel.
Terrifying, yet he combined this common sight with a piece of spirituality, which is the tornado or the cyclone being a portal into another realm.
Mm-hmm.
So the house is carried away and transported into another world. And this is really from theosophy as well, which believed in this concept of projecting yourself into a new realm called the astral plane or the astral light. And people believed that you could transport your body and have a whole experience where you might work out your fears and learn lessons of wisdom and compassion and courage, and then come back to the world of ordinary day transformed.
You know, it's kind of amazing sitting here in the 21st century looking back at the 19th. You call it New Age, and it does sound kind of incredible. Astral planes. We think of, I don't know, cowboys and Indians, and they were there. Sitting Bull, it plays a role here. We'll talk about it. But at the same time, they had this kind of sophisticated vocabulary. This wasn't a Kansas farmer writing this. This was someone who had studied sort of, cosmic travel.
Yes. And when you say vocabulary, I think that's really a key, because what Frank Baum did is he gave us a picture language that we all relate to. We take these common objects. It could be a hot air balloon or the Yellow Brick Road or the witch and her broomstick. And we all know what these things mean. And we talk about them every day. And The Wizard of Oz gets recycled in conversations and in YouTube mashups. It's the one story that we all have in common.
But this was a cyclonic time in cultural and economic terms, too. I mean, that sense of being thrown, the whole country had that feeling as you describe it.
Yes, it was a time of incredible change. New technologies were coming out, electric lighting. Of course, the trains were a big deal because now you could travel. And this was a big deal for Frank Baum when he went to Chicago. You know, all tracks led to Chicago.
To the great Columbian Exposition, the World's Fair, maybe the model for the Emerald City. But there had also been boom and bust and huge dislocation, much something like now. I mean, Americans had been through some real tough times.
Yeah. In fact, in 1893, when this World's Fair happened, there was a huge credit crisis, and it was very much like now. And people did want the comfort of home, even in this time of cyclonic change. And that, of course, that phrase, there's no place like home, was from Frank Baum's novel.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home. You look at the movie. I mean, it's made such an impression. What you remind us here, the American Film Institute's top 10, oldest movie in that top 10, Over the Rainbow, the number one movie song, they say, of all time. Why? The Wicked Witch of the West, the most frightening female in filmdom, they say, beaten out on their all-time villain list only by Hannibal Lecter, Norman Psycho Bates, and Darth Vader. I mean, these people are playing right up in the big leagues. And quotes, most memorable movie quotes on their list as well. Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too. And, of course, as you say, there's no place like home. It just resonates and resonates. You call Dorothy the Buddha. Like the Buddha, Dorothy attains enlightenment.
Yeah, it's really, some people look at it as a coming-of-age story, but it's really a transformation of consciousness story.
Why, tell you why, the ocean's near the shore. I could think of things I never thought before, and then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a nuffin, my head all full of stuffin, my heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry. Life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life behind The Wizard of Oz, about its writer and his surprising inspirations. My guest is Evan Schwartz. He's author of the new book, fascinating, provocative. It's called Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. It doesn't take much of a touch to put you right back there. The Wicked Witch of the West, one of the most terrifying villains in children's films, in any film. In this scene from the 1939 movie, she demands the ruby slippers from Dorothy's feet. Here's the Wicked Witch, played by Margaret Hamilton, with the Good Witch, Glinda, played by Billy Burke.
Give me back my slippers. I'm the only one that knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well.
Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone before somebody drops a house on you too.
Very well. I'll bide my time. And as for you, my fine lady, it's true, I can't attend you here and now as I'd like. But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog too.
And the hair stands on the backs of our necks. You have no power here to be gone. Well, we're not so sure. Evan Schwartz is with me in the studio. His book is Finding Oz, and it's terrific. Let's get Michael in Buffalo, New York, on the line. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing today?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Well, I have to say perfectly, when you played that piece, that embodies just a very good scope of how that movie was. It was basically staying the course, so to speak. And just to comment on Frank Baum's, you know, life, as far as when you made mention about all the things he did, as far as the businesses that he did, he failed, but he never gave up. And that, to me, is a very strong, it sends a real strong message, never give up. You know, the term, it's always used a lot, but if at first you don't succeed, try again.
Yep.
Yeah, and what Frank Baum was really doing was chasing the American dream. I mean, he was seeking his fortune. He wanted to support his family. Mm-hmm. But underneath it, he was trying to find out what's going to make me happy. It wasn't just a materialistic quest.
Though it was that. The American dream comes with the demons and fears. Hunger. He feared hunger.
And, of course, when you hear the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, I'll get you, my pretty. My earliest memory from my childhood is being terrified. And The Wicked Witch is more than just that mythic figure, though. She's really a metaphor for whatever our worst fears are. And it's sort of a rite of passage to get over that fear when you watch that movie as a kid. And what Frank Baum was doing was he was using the witch to symbolize whatever we're afraid of. And it could be fear of failure. It could be anything. But
so try again. But you crank it up even higher. You say transformation of consciousness, and you have to face that demon, that worst fear, in order to get through to self-realization. You quote Joseph Campbell all through this book about the hero and the journey. Of course, that wasn't out at all in Baum's time, but you think that was working anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's an ancient quest,
of course.
The monomyth, the hero's adventure. And Frank Baum didn't know about that. He didn't know about Freudian psychology. He was born in the same month as Sigmund mm-hmm. Freud. But he tapped into this. So he was using modern symbols but ancient ideas. And the Wicked Witch was partly inspired by his mother-in-law, as we mentioned. And I visited her house, which still stands near Syracuse. Mm. And her name was Mrs. Gage, Matilda Gage. Mm-hmm. She was Susan B. Anthony's most radical colleague, one of the leaders of the movement.
And an expert on medieval
witch hunts.
Yes. Witch hunts, excuse
me. She wrote a whole book really raging against churches and governments for creating this myth going back centuries of the Wicked Witch. Mm-hmm. And they were burned by the thousands across Europe. And, of course, the Salem witch trials. She studied this stuff to an extent where she was the leading authority on it. So witchcraft and this myth of the Wicked Witch was very much in his household. Frank Baum's mother-in-law would stay with the family for the winters, for most of the years.
And she wasn't gentle on Frank. She called her daughter a damn fool for marrying him.
Yes.
Was this his revenge? What did she think of this character in this book? Did she say, oh, that's me?
She didn't live to see it, but she inspired it. And she had her own transformation where she realized towards the end of her life that she was not going to see her dream come true, which was to see women get the right to vote.
Yes.
And she transformed into more of a mentor to Frank Baum. She mm-hmm. saw that he had a talent for telling stories to kids. Mm-hmm. She said, you need to write your stories down.
So she empowered him in a way after their tough start, their rugged start.
So she not only inspired the Wicked Witch, but also the Good Witch, Glinda.
Evan, give us some more moments, circumstances from his life that we will feel echoing in the story, in the movie of The Wizard of Oz. Circumstances that replay, transformed into fiction.
Well, he would take these symbols from his life. For one of the businesses that he failed at was selling cans of oil.
Mm-hmm.
It was a business called Baum's Castorine. And
oil was a new boom industry in itself,
yes,
in those days.
Yes, his mm-hmm. father was from the oil industry, competed mm-hmm. against Rockefeller. And he failed at this business too, even though he had a spectacular product for greasing axles of buggy wheels and machinery.
How could you lose?
And he sold these cans of oil that are really inspired the Tin Man's oil can. And the imagery of the Tin Man really came from his life. Frank Baum had a defective heart from a childhood disease. Hmm. And doctors...
He was beaten and fainted at the military school. They sent him home, back down that yellow brick road.
Yes, when he walked that yellow brick road, he went mm-hmm. to that military school. And he actually had a heart attack, or faked one incredibly well.
As a 12, 13-year-old.
Yeah, because he wanted to go back home. Mm-hmm. And he was a terrible military school student. He was a daydreamer. And when he would get punished. He would get, you know, caned, whipped mm-hmm. for daydreaming. So it was a terrible, fearsome place. And so he had this defective heart. Mm-hmm. He sold cans of oil, and that was the family business. And this company is still around. I visited it.
No kidding. Baum's Castorine Oil, even now? I can put it on my bicycle wheels?
In a suburb of Syracuse, they're doing really well 130 years later.
Oil and heart, and we hear all that in the movie. But let's take a little bit straight from the book. This puts it in his own words. Of course, it was called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and it's read here by Anna Fields. Dorothy, her little dog Toto, and the Scarecrow walking through the woods when they come across a most unusual sight, a man made entirely of tin.
His head and arms and legs were jointed upon his body, but he stood perfectly motionless, as if he could not stir at all. Dorothy looked at him in amazement, and so did the Scarecrow, while Toto barked sharply and made a snap at the tin legs, which hurt his teeth. "Did you groan?" asked Dorothy.
"Yes," answered the Tin Man. "I did. I've been groaning for more than a year, and no one has ever heard me before or come to help me."
"What can I do for you?" she inquired softly, for she was moved by the sad voice in which the man spoke.
"Get an oil can and oil my joints," he answered. "They are rusted so badly that I cannot move them at all. If I am well oiled, I shall soon be all right again."
The Tin Man found in the woods, straight from L. Frank Baum's famous book and even more famous movie, of course. Evan Schwartz is with me. He's written Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. All right, what's your astral plane interpretation of this interaction?
Well, on one level, the Tin Man's oil can seems like a product placement for Baum's Castorine.
Yes.
But there's that combination with the spiritual quest. And in Theosophy, the faith that he embraced, which is really based on the ancient religions of Hinduism and Buddhism, there's a quest along the golden path to enlightenment to learn these lessons.
And you mean literally, kind of through Theosophy, which was sort of the Euro spin on all that.
Exactly. And these quests were really meditations. They called them the four yogas, mm-hmm. and they were meditations on wisdom, on compassion, on courage, and finally inner harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And the four companions on the Yellow Brick Road are on these quests. They're each on their own mission to get those goals. And the Tin Man, of course, one of the most beloved characters, you know, in the movie, you notice Jack Haley, who has this wicked Boston accent, you know.
It's wonderful.
No hat.
Wonderful.
And all the characters are just played brilliantly.
Yeah.
But it was Frank Baum who created this iconic quest for each of the four characters.
And who knew it floated into Kansas down the Ganges, the Ganga. There's no end to what we want to hear. Let's get another call. David in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to present an idea. I saw a tornado when I was 12, and on occasion I've heard other tornadoes. An emerald green light shines out from the clouds. Very odd and unnatural. But
I know what you mean. A kind of a glowering green.
It's an odd color, yes.
Yes.
It occurred to me over the years that he may have been standing there looking at that, and the core idea of the Emerald City in the sky very possibly could have come from that. And I just wanted to throw that out.
Hey, great, great. Was there a house in that tornado you saw, David?
Well, there was things flying around in the air. It was quite dramatic, yes.
A witch on a bicycle?
Yeah.
Or nearly?
To a 12-year-old, it was very memorable.
Plenty.
And over the years, I said, oh, he must have been standing there looking up in the sky and seeing that green light and could have had one of the core things. You know, where do you get the idea?
Wonderful. Thanks, David. Evan Schwartz, the tornado, the color, and the Emerald City.
Well, emerald is a classic jewel that has some mystical qualities, and the color could represent hope and wonder. But, you know, people bring all kinds of interpretations to The Wizard of Oz, and you could see all kinds of meaning in it yourself. And there are, if you go on the internet and you try to figure out what is The Wizard of Oz really about, you'll encounter these myths that Frank Baum must have been on some kind of drug trip, that he got lost in the poppy field somewhere and hallucinated this story. Or another one that you'll find is that The Wizard of Oz is a parable of populism, of the political movement in the 1890s. And you'll see
green about greenbacks and...
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty widely in circulation, that.
Yeah, that the Yellow Brick Road is about the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And the slippers are originally silver in the book. They were changed to ruby because they looked better on the Yellow Brick Road on film, and that supposedly represented the silver standard to widen the money supply. And this is something I deconstruct in the book because it's based on a series of mistakes and a theory that was spun by a teacher in the 1960s.
I want to come to your Emerald City theory, but we've got a question on just this front from Charleston, South Carolina, and Matt. Matt, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your guest has already started to touch on what I was was wondering. But, you know, I grew up with the Wizard of Oz story and loved it. And then I remember getting into AP U.S. History in high school, and our teacher is telling us that it wasn't at all about what we had thought it was about, and that every little aspect had a political significance. And it was crazy that you know, the Scarecrow was the farm movement, and the Tin Man was the Industrial Revolution, and the greenbacks and gold standard, and I've looked at it since and seen that it's really every little aspect can be interpreted in that way. And so I was, your guest already began to talk about it, but I was wondering how much of that was a true meaning at the time, and how much is speculation after the fact.
That's great, Matt. Thank you very much. Evan, you're just beginning to deconstruct exactly this. So you hear that there's the widely heard story about the populist sort of finance, political explanation. You've got a spiritual explanation.
Yes, and it's fascinating. And I could see the Scarecrow representing farmers, the Tin Man, and the industrial workers. But all this theory started 60 years after Frank Baum wrote the book. He didn't intend this. And it was based on an error in one of the first biography of Frank Baum, written by his son as his son was dying, that said that Frank Baum was a populist Democrat who supported toppling the gold standard and Williams Jennings Bryant in the 1896 election. And what I found, I went back to read all his newspaper writings, because he edited a newspaper in Dakota during the rise of the populist movement. Mm-hmm. And it turns out Frank Baum was a lifelong Republican, admired Lincoln and then later Teddy Roosevelt. He was against the populists, wrote in a sort of derogatory way against this populist insurgency. Yet he wasn't that interested in politics, and he didn't intend this to be about that. There was a teacher in the 60s who wanted to teach summer school students about this time and created this populist theory and assigned all the icons to different things going on at the time. And it's been discredited. Even the teacher who created that theory, who was a wonderful man, I understand, his name was Henry Littlefield, has said there's no evidence that this was a populist theory. And I think it's distracted people from what the story really is about, which is something much deeper.
You go in a completely different direction among those spiritual notions that you say were lodged in the Oz creator's mind was the idea of astral travel, the notion that someone could be transported to an alternate state of consciousness and then return to this world transformed. And this from a man who had traveled to the Dakotas when there were still all kinds of problems there, in clashes with Native Americans, Sitting Bull he wrote about, and even some kind of genocidal writing about Native Americans. I want to come back in a minute and hear about that, how all that fits in.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unbelievable story on the face of it, and it's even more unbelievable when you really get deep into it. I mean, it's not as though you don't look in here and find all kinds of little connections yourself. You say, why was Toto called Toto?
Well, the name could have come from this theosophical concept of totality, which is a Latin phrase from in Toto, which means the unification of the different worlds. Kansas and Oz are actually part of the same world. The real world and the imagined are part of the same universe. And Toto is the only character, a very important character in the book, that understands, that treats both worlds the same.
Who knew? Who knew? Except the little dog.
Where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where you
why?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life behind The Wizard of Oz, about its writer and his surprising inspirations in the analysis of my guest today, Evan Schwartz, former editor at Business Week. He's written a really provocative, fascinating book, Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. He's with me in the studio right here, and all of our minds now buzzing with images and sound from The Wizard of Oz, The Cowardly Lion as Sitting Bull, the great Lakota chief, and his really kind of overwrought, well, at least sitting here in 2009, writing about Native Americans and Sitting Bull. Describe the link you make.
Yeah, this was a big turning point in American history that can't be underestimated. Of course, the Native Americans had this land before we came, and there were a series of wars for over 100 years. And the last big confrontation with Native Americans happened when Frank Baum was living in Dakota in 1890. And Sitting Bull was referred to as the lion of the Lakota people in the press all the time. And Frank Baum even referred to him as the king of the forest. He was the most revered and feared of the Native American chiefs. Mm. And yet he was also considered cowardly, because he ran away from the authorities in exile to Canada. And
it was portrayed that way.
Yes, he was quite harmless in the last years of his life, and he was a celebrity. He traveled with Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show. So he wasn't someone you would necessarily fear. Yet on December 15th, 1890, U.S. troops went in during what was perceived as an uprising during a famine on the Great Sioux Reservation, and they assassinated Chief Sitting Bull.
And Frank Baum wrote, "What wonder that a fiery rage still burned within his breast." It's been described, his writing is genocidal on Native Americans. What?
Yes, and this is a very controversial chapter in Frank Baum's life. It was really the low point of his life. He had seen all these businesses fail. He didn't want his newspaper to fail at this point.
In the Dakota territory.
In the Dakota territory. Mm-hmm. And he was writing these editorials basically to pander to his readers, to try to save his newspaper. And he was basically saying things that people wanted to hear, which was, these Indians are going to rise up against us and they're going to wipe us out, so we need to kill them first. And they were really genocidal editorials. And
so this went on way before talk radio, this
yes.
kind of whip it up and make a buck.
Exactly. It was like that. And the Indians were the terrorists of the Great Plains. I mean, people were scared that they would raid villages. And you can't underestimate what it was like to live on a frontier town out there.
You draw parallels everywhere. I mean, it sounds racist to you say it, but flying monkeys?
Flying monkeys are mythical creatures, and it could come from anywhere. I have a theory in the book. It could have been inspired by a Lakota legend of these mythical winged creatures called the Wakinyan, and they are like flying gargoyles. We don't know for sure, because Frank Baum, about a lot of these icons, never really spoke about it. Like many novelists, he was reluctant to say where everything came from.
You're very bold in your interpretations in here. I mean, I love it. It's very freewheeling. You're reaching all over. You've got lots of sources for this. But at other places, you're just sitting there kind of projecting back in time into this story. Wall Street Journal says the line between established fact and crackpot speculation here is not always easy to see. But I admire the way you've sort of boldly taken this up to look at it.
Well, essentially, what I try to do is put things in historical context. Mm-hmm. And the Indian uprisings back then, or the oil industry, or the World's
Theosophy,
Fair.
We'll come to that.
Mm-hmm. And these things played on the mythic imagination of a lot of Americans, and especially Frank Baum.
Let's go to Mike in Peru, New York. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm a little scared. The Wizard of Oz is in the air. The witch might be around.
Well, I was going to talk about that. I must have been 4 or 5 when I saw The Wizard of Oz, probably back in the early 1960s, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And, then later on in life, and I remember I was scared to death of the witch and maybe of the flying monkeys, too. The thought of a cloud of monkeys darkening the sky and coming down upon you.
What do you think gave it all so much power, Mike?
Probably my youth.
Yeah, well, that's a good start. But I know exactly what you mean. I remember watching from behind the sofa when I knew the witch was coming. I had to have something between me and that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike, thanks.
Well, that, and, you know, I mean, and you know, you believed in God and spirits and whatnot, and witches were part of that, really. And then to see it right there in front of you on TV, that was my first witch, I think.
Dive under the pillows quick. Thanks, Mike. Let's get a call from Westmore, Vermont, and Stan. Stan, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Listen to your show. First-time caller.
Great to have you.
The finding of the books of the Wizard of Oz, there were, of course, many of them, not just the Wizard. There was Glinda and the Wicked Witch and various things in his series. And when I was in fifth grade, I came home to a rental house that my parents had gotten for us for a while, and I just began to read a little bit, and I was hooked. Every single day I'd rush home from school to read more about the Wizard of Oz. There was something about his language, and you mentioned it, you alluded to it earlier, that he had such a pictorial language, and it was so fascinating the way he drew you into the scene. And eventually, I just retired a few years ago from 25 years of international radio broadcasting at the Voice of America.
Yeah.
I think the influence and the inspiration of L. Frank Baum was what got me on that track.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Out of the Wizard of Oz and into the world of international broadcasting, there's a kind of Oz. Stan, thank you. Let's hear some of that. You talk about the pictorial language. And let's hear a little bit more directly from the book, The Wonderful City of Oz, read here by Anna Fields here. And here's Dorothy entering Oz and her companions. They're required to wear green glasses to protect them from the city's, quote, brightness and glory.
Even with eyes protected by the green spectacles, Dorothy and her friends were at first dazzled by the brilliancy of the wonderful city. The streets were lined with beautiful houses, all built of green marble and studded everywhere with sparkling emeralds. They walked over a pavement of the same green marble, and where the blocks were joined together were rows of emeralds set closely and glittering in the brightness of the sun. The window panes were of green glass. Even the sky above the city had a green tint, and the rays of the sun were green. There were many people, men, women, and children, walking about, and these were all dressed in green clothes and had greenish skins.
There we go. We're at the Emerald City. You remind us of the Chicago Exposition. Even though things weren't going well, he got his family there, and you see it as a model for...
Well, of the Emerald City of Oz. And, yes, Chicago was the major hub of America, and the World's Fair drew... 1 in 4 Americans in 1893.
That blew my mind. I'd never read that. 1 in 4 Americans came to the Great Columbian Exposition, the White City.
Oh. Yes, because before the internet or television or radio, this is how you found out about new ideas mm-hmm. and all the wonders of the age. And Frank Baum moved to Chicago so he could be there in this exciting time. Mm-hmm. And he worked as a newspaper reporter, and he covered a press conference. This is an article I uncovered that no one's really seen before. Mm. A press conference by Thomas Edison, the Wizard of Menlo Park. Mm-hmm. And Edison announced that he's going to reveal his great invention, his new invention, his third invention, which was motion pictures after the light bulb and the phonograph. And in part, the wizard is inspired by real-life figures. The wizard, I think, is the most fascinating character in the book because he's like a shapeshifter.
Yes.
He changes from being wonderful like a Thomas Edison to being a fraud or to being someone who you're afraid of. And
what's your interpretation there? I mean, he's mainly a fraud, isn't he, in The Wizard of Oz?
Yes. And that goes to the heart of the lesson of the book, which is mm-hmm. self-reliance. Don't put all your hopes in someone like, you know, the wizard who you don't even know, just like we do with a lot of investment advisors mm-hmm. today mm-hmm. or people who manage our money. Mm-hmm. These wizards don't really know what they're doing. And that's a very American thing. And when you play that clip of the green spectacles, mm-hmm. people were willing in the original novel to put on these green eye shades so that everything appeared green.
Looked green, looked verdant.
Like money, mm-hmm. right? And people were willing to go along with that con, and that's a very American thing. And Frank Baum also was fascinated and wrote many articles about P.T. Barnum, the great showmaster, the great ringmaster of the age, the great con man. And Barnum was known for deceptive advertising, and Frank Baum was fascinated with how deceptive advertising works better than honest advertising.
And never mind all the booms and busts that America had already seen, the land booms, the research, oil booms, gold boom, bust. The late 19th century was absolutely full of that. But we all know, even in the, more than a century later, how to slip on those green glasses. Maybe they're off right now. Jim, in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Jim.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Schwartz. What a pleasure it is to be on, Tom. I love your show. I've been listening to it for years, and it was an honor to be on now. I just wanted to say that The Wizard of Oz is one of my favorite stories, one of my favorite films of all time. The music is incredible. It's fantastical. My question really is specific to what Mr. Schwartz thinks. What is his take on the Broadway musical Wicked, and how I'm sure he's familiar with, as many of your listeners are, and probably you as well, that story kind of twists everything around and reverses things, where Glinda is really the bad one, bad witch, and the Wicked Witch of the West is simply misunderstood, and Glinda it's all full of hypocrisy, and the Wicked Witch of the West is misunderstood because she's green.
right.
I'd like to know what your thoughts are about that.
Great, thanks, Jim. Evan, how did you respond to Wicked after all this work?
Well, the musical's phenomenal, and I enjoyed Gregory Maguire's novel as well, and it's brilliant. I think Frank Baum would have been jealous because he wrote 14 sequels to his original book, actually 14 Oz novels altogether.
Yeah.
But he never wrote a prequel. And that's how I look at...
Hadn't thought of that, maybe.
That's how I look at Wicked. It's the backstory of the Wicked Witch of the West, and it gives her dimensionality, and you get sympathy for her. And what it brings to mind for me is Frank Baum's inspiration for The Witches of Oz, that there's... that the line between good and evil is not always clear, and we assign wickedness to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to the heart of probably the most important scene in the movie and the book is when Dorothy kills the Wicked Witch, destroys her just with a bucket of water.
Yeah, and it's gone. Once she's brave enough to say no to that,
yes.
Just throw the water.
Which suggests that there wasn't much to the Wicked Witch to begin with, that it was something, the wickedness is created in your mind.
Find your fear, face your fear, and on we go. Jim, in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Jim, our time is short, but you're on the air, sir.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I don't want to say anything else about, I'm glad someone else brought Wicked. I don't want to give away the end if they haven't had the pleasure to see it. But L. Frank Baum, phenomenal books. And Mr. Schwartz, thanks for writing your book. And I think it's so timely because this year is the 40th anniversary of Judy Garland's passing.
Yes.
And I don't know about you, but that movie got me hooked on her.
Yeah, who wouldn't be hooked on her? I mean, she's a goddess in American narrative out of that Dorothy and Judy Garland. Let's listen to Judy Garland. We don't have the witch water throwing moment, but we've got the moment when she faces down The Wizard of Oz here, 1939, the film, the wizard played here, and Judy Garland as Dorothy.
I am Oz, the great and powerful. Who are you? Who are you?
If you please, I am Dorothy. The small and meek. We've come to ask you.
Silence!
Oh! Oh! Jiminy Cricket!
The great and powerful Oz knows why you have come. Step forward!
Oh, Jiminy Cricket, says Judy Garland. The small and meek, she describes herself. But you describe her by the end of this film as the accomplished cosmic traveler, a hero in Joseph Campbell terms, and a female in that role.
Yeah, well, I agree with the caller that Judy Garland is riveting almost every moment of that film. Mm. And what is amazing about this scene is the dialogue is right from Frank Baum's novel, I Am Oz, the Great and Powerful. I am Dorothy, the small and meek. Jiminy Cricket was sort of an interjection that is kind of fun that she would say something like that at that moment. And this is, of course, the pivotal scene where she is confronting the Great Oz and is going to be sent on this mission with her companions to kill the Wicked Witch. So Oz is really out to get the witch. And this is sort of a subtext that the great and powerful Oz wants to control the Western territory that the Wicked Witch controls in the Land of Oz.
She emerges here as a hero with her compatriots, you say, a kind of hero who doesn't have it all for herself, shares it with her three fellow travelers, pilgrims. But you're right, the other hero here is L. Frank Baum himself. We just got half a minute, but what do you mean by that?
Well, Frank Baum's, he's a hero because it took everything he had, wisdom, compassion, courage, to go back to his true self, to realize his dream of becoming a great writer, which he had when he was a little kid. Very few of us get to experience that. You know, life gets in the way. Mm-hmm. And he achieved great bliss, great happiness in his own life, but he brought happiness to billions of people. I mean, more people have seen the movie The Wizard of Oz than any other film in history, an estimated 2 billion people. So he's a hero because he did something that was true to himself, and he also made the world happy for over 100 years.
Well, it is an incredible story and backstory and movie. The backstory and all of your meta-analysis we're very grateful for. Evan Schwartz's book is Finding Oz, How L. Frank Baum Discovered the Great American Story. What a journey. Thank you for taking us back through it in a whole new way. Thank you, Evan Schwartz, for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, we'll leave you right there on the Yellow Brick Road and the Wizard with the Wizard of Oz. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.